welcome. Hey, good guys. Evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you are. Good welcome to another episode of The Coffee Break. I'm Daniel, here as usual with my friend Tom.
Hey,
Tom.
Guys, how's it going? Good to be here.
Today, most interesting episode yet. Probably. Maybe.
Let's say one of the most interesting episodes.
One of the most.
I brought a good friend here.
What's up? We're going to start straight up with our guest today because there's a lot to talk about and we kind of want to have enough time to talk about everything.
Yeah.
So, hi, Isaac. Welcome.
Hi, good afternoon.
What's up? We're happy to have you.
Good to be here.
You want to tell a little bit about yourself and... tell us a bit about yourself and what you're doing here in Israel and where you're from and all those kind of things, and then we'll jump straight to the interesting stories.
Sure, of course. I'll keep it short and sweet. You know, that's what I like to do, I guess. made Aliyah from London, England, for those that don't know. 6 months in Ulpan, learned Hebrew, joined the army, paratrooper, Tzanchanim, became a sniper, which I'm guessing you're going to talk about more.
Yes, was on the
yeah, you think it's interesting for people? Okay, no,
you know, I know that's for you to, that's for the people to decide, really. Was on the Gaza border for 4 months, spent some time in Hebron, just finished now a few days ago, so enjoying the free life, enjoying freedom.
Nice.
Yeah, so yeah, basically I met Isaac through a mutual friend. They both made Aliyah and they studied Hebrew in Ulpan together. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we've been hanging out in Chumus Yosef, where me and you usually go. Yeah, it's a great Chumus place.
Classic place.
So yeah, we've been hanging out there a little bit. And the cool thing is that, so one day he sends me, like, Tom, listen, I wrote this... answer to a question in Quora about what's happening on the border with Gaza.
Yeah.
And it got like 50,000 views already. And I was like, whoa. Because in Quora, it's that's a lot of views.
Yeah.
You know, usually I know that if you get like 1,000 or 2,000 upvotes, it's considered like viral for Quora. You know?
I think 50,000 views is a lot for everywhere.
It's maybe a lot.
Like Twitter or Facebook or Instagram.
Yeah. But
it's not. It's more popular than Quora, which is
true.
Like,
true. But Quora, you know, some of the
answers. What was the question? What people asking, and what did you answer?
The question in general was someone asked about the protests in Gaza, but the way he phrased it, you could see that it was something slightly with a bias against Israel. Mm-hmm. And
well, what do you mean? Like what?
He phrased it in a way, he used specific words. I think, he used the term unarmed protesters. Why is it fair that we get to do what we do? Mm-hmm. I can't remember the exact phrasing, but it was clearly, you know, something, someone looking to make some sort of anti-Israel question.
Looking to start a fight.
Yeah, which, you know, on the internet, when it comes to Israel, it's you know, you'll find the fight.
These are the best kind of fights.
Yeah, we talked about it on our last episode.
Yeah. All right. And then you decided to take initiative.
Yeah. To be honest, I can't tell you that I really planned this out. It was like the middle of the night. I was planning to go to sleep. And I don't know, just doing some reading before falling asleep. And I said, you know, as a person that's really been there, because I saw all kinds of answers of people who... or have never even been to Israel. They just, I don't know, read news articles.
Mm-hmm.
Or people who have been in Israel, but, you know, clearly they haven't been on the border itself. And, you know, me being a sniper there.
Yeah, it's not a very touristy spot, so.
Well, you know, I have a few stories of protesters who somehow managed to get there, which is interesting. But, you know, being a sniper who was really on the fence, sometimes literally, you know, I can really give a good account and at least try to give some evidence and get the truth out there. And that's what I did. You know, I wrote it in like 20 minutes and suddenly the next day I'm just getting email after email every 5 minutes over a new notification with this. And I don't know, it got very popular very quickly.
Wow.
So... Just to make things straight, let's say a normal Friday for you. How would a normal Friday would look for you? So
just to give a bit of context, though. So there have been protests / riots on the border with between Gaza and Israel for the past year and a half now already, something like that.
Yes. Yep.
And usually what happens is that every one of these riots has some people who are injured or dead. End up dead or something like that.
Yes.
And it's been on the news quite a lot, especially in Israel, but also generally in the world.
Yes, right. It's important to say, we're not trying to, we don't know all the facts all of the time, and I personally don't think there's one side that is right. I think that maybe it's always like, it's complicated reality. Most of the dead were from the Palestinian side, most of the injured, and that's because various reasons we'll hear about. Those protests, they often are portrayed just as protests, but there's usually something more behind it. So usually it's maybe civilians, and then there's some Hamas combatants within them trying to do all sorts of things, harm soldiers in a certain way or stuff like that. And that usually what causes the dead. Some of the dead are civilians, some are not. It's a very complicated reality, so we don't want to say, look, they are right, we are wrong, we are wrong, we are right, they are wrong. It's not about that. It's about talking about the reality and the complicated reality, and maybe hearing first person about what happened.
So describe us to us what a normal Friday, not a normal, but what an average Friday
right,
would look like.
It's a bit different from the Fridays I see now, thankfully. But so really, to describe it, you have to tell me, you know, from what period, why? Because the protests have gotten a lot quieter, a lot less violent lately, which is good. You know, of course, everyone wants that. But, you know, let's say at the peak when it was most violent, you know, we would wake up at about 4 or 5 a.m., go to the shooting range, make sure that all of the sniper rifles work and all that. And by 10 a.m., we'd already be in the border area, setting up, deciding positions, etc. And their protests are meant to start after the afternoon prayer. So around 1-ish, it would start getting full. And then until sundown, you know, when they have their next prayer, or until it gets dark for some reason, you know, they didn't like the cold, so, you know, they would go back home.
They're going back home for Shabbat dinner. So
you would be probably like lying down on a dirt patch somewhere, or
right?
And with your rifle, and you were alone, or there were other snipers with you?
So you're at the very least, you have a pair. It really depends on how many people you have available. You know, the preference is that you have three guys: the sniper, the spotter, and then like a commander who kind of, you know, he's with the walkie-talkie, kind of relaying orders and stuff like that. That's the preference.
So it's like a sniper unit.
Yeah. It'll always be a squad, a small squad like that. And then 500 meters to your right or left, there would be another one like that. And, you know.
So you would lie down? You would look through your scope the entire time? Or?
Well, you know, with a lot of Fridays and a lot of protests, you get experience. You know, the first time you're there, you're very nervous. So, yeah, it's just lying down for 5 hours, making sure everything's okay and, you know, nothing's breaking out. But with the time, you see a lot of patterns. So towards the end, you know, I really had a good feeling for when something's about to break out, when it's too quiet, you could say. And it really did happen like that, where there'd be an hour where it's just dead quiet and you know it's not meant to be like this.
Yes.
And, you know, on the other side, they also know we're there and they've gone quite smart. They would actually know in the last hour. Normally all the snipers, you know, they're tired, they're a bit less alert. So most of their big attempts to break the fence would actually happen in like the last half hour, last 15 minutes, when we're kind of at our least alert. So,
okay. And what, I mean, I think that all three of us know why they're trying to break through the fence.
Right.
Like, for us, it's very understandable.
I think there's two reasons. I think, personally, I think one reason is the classic, we want to, I mean, it's Hamas combatants or whatever, and they want to harm Israelis.
Yeah.
And I think the second is they're trying to break out. They're trying to maybe get arrested by Israel and escape the reality in Gaza.
Yeah.
I can tell you, you know, for sure that happens. We've stopped the guys that have tried to do that. That, you know, you catch them on the other side of the fence, and they tell you openly, you know, I've got nothing else going there behind me. They say they'll bring a knife or something, you know, a reason for you to arrest them and put them in prison. But it's clear they don't really want to attack Israelis. They just
walk around with a knife in their pocket.
Yeah, they've just heard, you know, their cousin or whatever who's been thrown into an Israeli prison and suddenly has three meals a day. He can study, you know, there are a lot of former or current Hamas agents in this jail, you know, so he has a community even. And, you know, life is
pretty good.
Yeah, pretty good in contrast to what they have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard stories about the situation in Gaza in terms of, like, food, sanitation?
Of course.
Stuff like that?
Yeah, of course, it's horrible. And it's, you know, it's horrible, but at the same time, I also hear stories where Israel does try to send humanitarian aid.
Yes.
And Hamas routinely rejects it at the border. So, okay. I mean...
Yeah. That happened during my time. When I served as a medic on the border, and there were a lot of times that we would try to like send aid, and either they just confiscate it and, you know, give it to whoever they want, mm-hmm. or they just flat out reject it.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? Why?
Well, I can tell you one thing for Hamas. It's a sad reality that the way they won popularity is through how anti-Israel they are. Why were they able to kick out the PA? Was because the PA was seen as making too many consolidations with Israel agreements.
The PA, for whoever doesn't know, it's the Palestinian Authority. It's the main body that represents Palestinians around the world.
Yes.
And it's currently a rival politically for Hamas. Yeah. They've got a rivalry that sometimes, you know, becomes a physical rivalry as well. So really, people, you have to remember that in Gaza, the people democratically voted for Hamas in the beginning. Why? On their extremism.
The situation was very different back then, though. Situation in Gaza, and the idea about Hamas as an organization was kind of different. They were a terrorist organization, extremist mm-hmm. organization mm-hmm. back then. But the situation was much different than it is now.
Mm-hmm. Also, they were seen as less corrupt,
yes,
more moral.
Yes, that's true. Also, I mean, you could say that the PA was in charge of Palestinian politics since, like, I don't know, forever, '60s or something.
The founding,
and then they felt like they wanted a change. Things mm-hmm, weren't working out, so they trying to vote for the new guy. You could say, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
For the new party, that's mm-hmm. or organization, you can say,
mm-hmm.
and I think the main reason was why Hamas was elected. Also, you couldn't really know like corruption and stuff like that. You can't really know how democratic it was, but that's not the point.
Yeah.
So currently the situation is quite bad. I would say maybe mostly because of Hamas, but I'm guessing it's some sort of a...
You know, there's always political deadlock between the two sides, but I mean, Hamas is a very tough partner to dance with, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have, like we talked about before, with the Palestinian Authority, which Israel is also trying to make some sort of agreement with, make some sort of breakthrough with. So they routinely reject any sort of agreement with Hamas because they see it as like a usurper of their right to govern the Palestinians.
Yes.
So it's like a three-way issue where like no one's ever happy. There's always one side that's unhappy with what's going
on. And the civilians
suffer because of that.
Suffers.
Yeah.
But, you know, the civilians also, you know, maybe I'm a bit extreme, but this just really from what I saw, they also share a bit of blame,
tell us about that blame. Tell us about like what you would see, because many times those protests are portrayed as peaceful, mm. but I'm guessing sometimes they are, sometimes they're mm. not. I mean,
yeah.
tell
also
us about
it feels a bit like when it's being portrayed in the media, especially in the media in Europe, for example, or let's say the UK,
mm-hmm.
That they are, you know, peaceful protesters fighting for their rights that mm. are being taken away from them
right.
by Israel or something like that.
Right.
I think the rights are taken away from them, maybe mostly by Hamas and a bit by Israel because the situation, there's a certain situation that that was created because of Palestinian policy and Israeli policy probably. I just think that mostly those civilians suffer because of a decision made by them and by Israel and they're kind of hostage, right?
Yeah, but okay.
But
yeah,
I want to hear. Exactly. I want to hear about the protest, and maybe you say that civilians have that the Palestinian civilians have some right. blame in them, and I'm sure right. it might be true. And I wanted to like, why do you think?
Yeah, before I get into that, you know, I want to also preface that, yeah, I think the Palestinian people are definitely being used and abused,
100%, yeah.
you know, by their own government, and I guess people around the world would say by Israel. I don't know how much that is true, but you know, by their own government. So when I say they share the blame, you know, it's also hard to say that because, you know, from a young age, they're just educated that all of their problems are because of Israel. And really every single problem they encounter in life is really Israel's fault. And I think that's a big issue. But apart from that, why I think that they kind of share some of the blame, a lot of these protests have big political overtones. Now, what I mean by that is between Hamas and the Israeli government, that us, the soldiers in the field, would really feel on our shoulders. There was a specific period of time where Hamas, in an effort to do some short-term peace agreement, they said, okay, we don't support these protests anymore. And they made it very official, and it was very clear, and it was published in the news. Hamas no longer supports these. Next Friday, do not come and protest. We don't support this. We don't want you to protest. So, you know, we thought that maybe it would be a bit more calm. But, you know, Friday comes, what happens? It's the same amount of people. They're violent. They're, you know, throwing Molotov cocktails and such. And, you know, that really taught me something, that this is something that the civilians want, regardless of Hamas. This is something that the civilians themselves really want. They want to breach this fence. They want to do this. Because Hamas already wasn't supporting it. Hamas wasn't part of the calculation here.
That's very interesting you're saying that, because a lot of times when I hear maybe a bit less military officials but more government officials, they keep repeating this message that our fight is with Hamas, it's not with the Palestinian people mm-hmm. in Gaza. Mm-hmm. So it's actually very interesting to me that you say that, because I was Yes, I agree with you that mm-hmm. You know, the people in Gaza do share some of the blame for their situation, of course, because you can't blame only mm-hmm. one side for whatever is happening. But I always thought that many of them, I felt like, you know, they made a mistake. They voted for Hamas, but now they realize that they're actually being used mm-hmm. and they wouldn't really want it.
Okay. Like I said, this was a really big turning point for me. I thought exactly like you before that. And, you know, the facts are in front of my eyes, you mm-hmm. know, every Friday for that period. I think it was like 2 or 3 weeks that Hamas didn't support these protests whatsoever.
But it just same numbers, same attacks.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe okay. you didn't have the Hamas agents within them uh-huh. who would often, you know, get them angrier.
Yeah.
But here's another, some more evidence that this is really something the civilians want. Because at the same time, another issue became with the Jihad Islami, that's Palestinian Jihad, which is... a smaller political group, which is even more extreme than
Hamas.
Yeah,
they are pretty radical.
That they actually kept telling the citizens, no, keep doing these protests, it's your right, etc. Mm-hmm. And they actually gained popularity in these months.
Yeah.
Why? Because the civilians started seeing that Hamas is starting to make what they saw as concessions to Israel.
Compromising.
Yeah. And then suddenly this even more radical group is gaining popularity. So, you know, you have to ask yourself, if the citizens keep going for the more radical party that keeps preaching more and more violence, you know, you kind of see what they're after.
So let's go back to actually what's happening on the ground there. So you as a sniper, what you said, for example, that you have Hamas agents mm-hmm. trying to stir things up. Mm-hmm. And things, like, could you see something happening?
Yeah, could you spot those agents?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Sometimes they would be, you know, they would wear the flag as like a bandana or whatever, and it would be very obvious that they're...
That they are Hamas.
Yeah. Okay. And then other times, no, but there are people that like come every week, and you can see that they always have a group of people around them following them. And
you recognize it's the same people?
Yeah, of course, okay. Of course. I mean, there was even... Not connected to the protests, you know, there was one guy that was like a known bomb maker from, like, we had the intelligence that he was a bomb maker. Mm-hmm. And he would be walking around these protests at a safe distance, like we weren't allowed to shoot him. But, you know, you see this very well-known Hamas bomb maker.
Wait, so, sorry, you just said you were not allowed to shoot him.
Right, so we had we always had a set of rules before each protest. They would change here and there in regards to, you know, what distance are we allowed to shoot? When are we allowed to shoot above the legs, above the knees? You know, they would definitely, every day before the protest, they would tell us in a very ordered manner exactly what, you know, what we're allowed to do and what we're not allowed to do. Mm-hmm. And in general, opposite the border, at least in our area, I was in the south of the Gazan border.
Yeah.
There's a trail on their side that's that it's parallel to the fence all the whole way. And it's about 400, 500 meters. It changes a bit, but it's around 400, 500 meters. And the agreement between Hamas and Israel was that we'll respect these protests as long as you don't pass this trail. Like, they had a geographic line that they knew.
Mm-hmm.
And we were never allowed to shoot anyone who was on the trail or before it. So that was, you know, that would never change.
Yeah.
And sometimes it would be even more strict, like, you know, you're only allowed if he's on the fence, 100 meters from the fence. You know, it would, that would change depending on the protest, but it was never above that trail.
Mm.
Yep.
Okay.
So you say the orders were very clear. Mm-hmm. So each sniper always knew. Okay, so the orders were very clear, but the reality is, like we said, complex, and things mm-hmm. change, and things mm-hmm. are dynamic, and mm-hmm. so sometimes you have to, sometimes you or other snipers, you had to make decisions that maybe don't fall 100% inside the lines of the orders, or it was always mm-hmm. like 100% clear before you shoot, you know, that you made the right decision.
Mm-mm-mm. Let's put it this way: there were always red lines that, like,
no matter what,
you're not gonna cross this line, and we all knew that beforehand. No one ever crossed those kinds of lines. In terms of, if there's an emergency, someone's, you know, actively cutting down the fence, or he has a Molotov cocktail in his hand and he's throwing it, then yeah, we might shoot and only report it the second after, because you yes. just don't have time to report that yeah. kind of thing.
But it's always like those shots were always like it was always clear to you that you need to shoot.
Of course. And also, you know, it's not like there were no records. You always had to record.
Yes, yes, yes.
The sniper himself, he has a camera attached to his lens.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so I didn't know that.
Right. A lot of people don't know that. And I learned that from the answer that I gave, that really almost no one knew this. And it's actually relatively new when we just moved into Gaza.
Yeah. It's a very smart, actually. It's very, very
smart. It's very smart, yes.
It's, yes. For the situation that we're in, it's incredibly smart.
It's very smart, and it's very humane also.
It's very humane. It gives a lot of evidence to back up, you know, what we're doing, and to make sure that there's not some lone shooter, you know, going crazy, which, you know, yeah. maybe it could happen.
Yeah.
You know, God forbid. And actually, even more so, it actually makes our job as a sniper a lot harder.
You yes. need,
because, you know...
You know, there's a record. You know, there's... would know.
No, not just like that, but the actual... you know, shooting, you're less accurate with this, and you know
that. Oh, really?
Right. It slightly affects the scope. Okay. Slightly, but you know,
but when you're
aiming at someone's knee at 300 meters, you know, you have to be very good at what you do.
That's actually something that that I find that a lot of people don't know, especially when I'm talking. So, for example, now as part of my job in the student union at university, I'm mm-hmm. in charge of the foreign students,
mm-hmm.
and I organized the panel for them. There's a very big group that came. Most of them are from France, but also from Slovakia, Austria, Russia, the UK as well. And, you know, no one really does military service from where they come from. Mm-hmm. They don't really know it. It's not as ingrained in the society as it is here. And so a lot of mm-hmm. them ask me questions, for example, like, oh, you know, why do they have to shoot the leg? Why can't they shoot the knife out of the guy's hand or something like that? and because they genuinely don't know. They never shot a gun before, and so they don't understand, and it's hard for them to understand. Mm-hmm. It's not like a Jackie Chan movie
right.
that you can just, you know. Yeah.
Do you want me to like answer? You
know, yeah, of course, man. Of course. It's very interesting.
Okay. To be honest, you know, first of all, it's not the whole leg because, you know, in the thigh you have artery, yeah, which if you accidentally shoot that, you'll just kill the person.
Yeah.
So it's also not even the entire leg. It's really from the kneecap and lower,
mm-hmm,
even the foot. And I guess they chose that as a general rule of thumb because, you know, with a hand, the person can move it and it's a very small target. And, you know, with the leg, you just shoot and the guy's not going to move and he's probably not going to throw any grenades or anything, which has also happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a much safer bet. You know, the sniper doesn't now have to think, oh, do I shoot him in the hand or do I shoot him in the leg? And, you know, has to make that decision. It just removes that decision from us.
Yeah, simple order, kneecap down.
Yeah.
But if you have a guy throwing a grenade right now,
if he's in the act and you've got foolproof and all that, that he's got a grenade and he's planning to throw it, you're allowed to shoot to kill.
All right, but okay, let's say, okay, maybe a grenade is a bit harder to see before, but let's say he has a Molotov cocktail.
Also,
it's very easy to see that he's holding in his hand. But what if he's not throwing it right now?
That's one of the very tough gray areas that we faced. You know, in the Israeli army in general, anytime you want to shoot to kill, you need to find three rules. And this isn't just for snipers, this is for every combat soldier. He has to have an object that he can kill with, he has to have the possibility to kill with it, and he has to have the want to use it to kill.
Yeah.
So without those three things, you'll never...
The intention, basically.
The intention, exactly.
The first two are very hard, are very easy to find. Right. The third is very, very hard.
Exactly.
It's almost impossible.
Yeah, it depends on the context, you know. From there, if he's just... It's hard because, you know, if the guy's just standing around and he's got a Molotov cocktail in the middle of a protest, you know, you can pretty much guess that he's planning to throw it at some point.
Yeah.
So in general, if you see something like that and it's already lit, that means it's going to, you know, burn his hand if he doesn't throw it. So you know he's going to throw it.
Yeah.
So you'll shoot. The second he's thrown it, here's the, maybe it's a paradox, maybe not, but the second he's thrown it, you don't have, you can't shoot him anymore to kill. It's only to in the legs. The second he's thrown it, you can't do that because he doesn't have the object to kill anymore.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested. So we talked about situations where people were throwing grenades and Molotov cocktails and stuff like that. So what do you have more stories about? Were you attacked in any way or? Things were thrown at you, or you were shot at, or would that something that would happen regularly, or you have maybe a specific story that?
I've got plenty of stories. To be honest, in the beginning when I just moved to the border, it was a lot more violent, and it's calmed down a lot more. You really don't hear about grenades and Molotov cocktails anymore, thankfully. Once I've had a Molotov cocktail dropped maybe 5 meters from me.
So you had to like run from the fire?
Well, we were in our position, and the position itself is relatively well guarded. So you know, it was thrown, it landed, and it was manageable. What else? I've had friends who have been shot at. Yep, you have like just a sudden spray of AK-47 bullets, and you know, most of the time they're not aiming to kill, they're just throwing these bullets around to scare you, which, you know, that might sound it's pretty scary, but you know that they're not aiming to kill you with it. Of course, you always have the threat of snipers. I myself was positioned opposite a building where they actually saw that they're setting up some sort of sniper position. Besides the snipers, us, but they also have observation units that have like telescopes that can, you know, they can identify a person's face kilometers within Gaza. So through those observation posts, they actually saw they're building some sort of sniper position. And that, and on a few of my last protests, my job was actually just to be a counter sniper. Like, I wasn't with the protest whatsoever. I was in a different position. And if a Hamas sniper would show up, then it would be my job to neutralize that, I guess. So I've also seen that.
Whew. Damn.
Yeah, that's.
I just remembered it's The Enemy Within, the name of this movie. Do you know what I mean? I think it's called The Enemy Within.
What?
Or wait, it's about it's about Russian snipers.
No, Enemy at the Gates.
Enemy at the Gates.
Enemy at the Gates. Yeah. Enemy at the Gates.
Yeah. An incredibly famous real story. Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. It's
You know, thankfully, or I don't know, not thankfully, I don't know. No sniper ever showed up on those protests that I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing.
Do they have the equipment? Do Hamas has the proper sniping equipment?
Yeah, they have an Austrian-made sniper rifle that's efficient up to a kilometer and a half, something like that.
Ooh.
Do we use an Israeli one or American? Remington, no?
We use an American one, and then there's another one for large distances.
Okay.
The one that I used for the counter-sniper operation.
Ah,
that's a larger caliber, and it's a...
The one that hurts your shoulder when you...
Yeah, yeah. When you you have to do a course specifically for this, and just every person leaves with an Bruce. Injury for life on their
oh
shoulder.
My God.
Because of the recoil.
Yeah, the recoil is pretty intense.
Wow.
But
what's the let's talk a bit. What's the furthest shot you ever take? When you take a shot, do you know the distance or?
Yeah, you have to know the distance. No.
Well, to some degree, you have to know like. Maybe not the exact meter to the meter, but you have to know, I don't know, the difference between 350 and 300 is pretty noticeable in how the bullet drops. So, yeah, you do have to know that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're asking me, this is going to sound morbid, but you're asking me on a person or on a target, like in a shooting range?
I would say, like, real life action.
Okay, real life. My furthest is about 340, 360 on a moving
meters.
Target, yeah.
And when you take on a moving, and when you take a shot like that, you have to take into account bullet travel and bullet drop. And
right. The
wind.
Well, at 300 meters, the time the bullet takes to reach, you know, it's not that much. Bullet drop. Yep. You
but
definitely
wait, you
have to take into
40,
account.
40, 360. What did you say?
The meters. How, the
340,
distance?
360.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
340,
okay.
360.
I thought you meant 40, 360. I was like, wait, 4,360
no,
meters?
No,
that's,
no.
A, that's a bit of a long time.
Maybe one day. But
one day. Okay. I actually, so yeah, I mean, it seems, for me at least, on a, maybe on a more personal level, that, like, did you know that this is what you're going into when you joined the paratroopers? When
nope.
you came to live in Israel, you're like, I'm going to
nope.
leave the UK. I'm going
to. I'll be completely honest with you. First of all, I wanted to go to Magellan, but I was sick on the tryout, so
okay.
they didn't take me.
It's
so.
A different unit, like more elite.
A commando unit, basically.
Okay.
But, you know, whatever. I went to paratroopers and so, which is a great unit. You know, it's constantly winning awards. And
I have a warm
like
spot for them because my father was in.
My father, too.
A soft spot for them,
wow,
sorry.
Nice,
yeah.
nice. Yeah, everyone knows someone who's been in paratroopers somehow. But yeah, it's a great unit. I also wasn't interested in being a sniper whatsoever. And to be a sniper in the Israeli army, it's not like every draft can do that. It's once every couple of drafts. And my draft happened to fall on that had the option to go to a sniper squad. Again, I wasn't that interested in it. You know, I shot decently, but not amazingly. So I was drafted into a different squad, completely different. And the
but
last,
if you weren't a good shot, why did they take you? I mean, you were good.
I was all right, you know. But
yeah.
Exactly. So my platoon commander in the boot camp and stuff, he
saw a spark in you, and
yeah, well, something like that. Because he was actually a commander of a sniper squad in Duv Devan, which is, you know, a different commando unit whose sniper squad is. Very, very, very good.
Wow.
And he actually moved me to the sniper squad in paratroopers just on a whim. I didn't ask him. It was a bit surprising. And I asked him why, and he said...
That's army for you.
Yeah, a lot of that happens a lot in the... But usually for bad, not for good.
Yeah.
And I asked him, you know, why did you make this change? And he said, you know, he moved me on based on my personality.
Hmm.
So... I can be a bit apathetic at times. Let's put it that way.
You think that's something that the sniper needs to have?
Definitely. You know, there's a joke in all the sniper squads that they only take Russians because they're very cold blooded and cold hearted.
Mm.
And
that's hard, man. That's hard.
And
as,
you know,
as a half Russian, I resent.
And in my squad, there are three Russians, so you know, I can't say the stereotype isn't wrong. But
but
you know,
would,
But maybe I'm probably the most apathetic person in the squad. Everyone else, you know, they love to, you know, they're lively people, you know.
I wouldn't say you're apathetic. I know you. Like, you're a pretty good
guy.
Yeah,
I like to laugh, you know.
You're just British. You have your...
maybe.
Can you tell a bit about... Could you tell a bit about the psychological aspect behind being a sniper? Because, I don't know, it's when I think about it, it's probably, like, the hardest job I could think about, like, in the army, because you have to be extremely cool. You have to... execute at a high level, an extremely difficult task, which is shooting someone, sometimes to kill, and you usually probably see the person you're going to shoot very well. So how would you say that, like, it affects you, if anything, like, you specifically or other people you know?
So I can only speak about myself and what I've seen amongst my squad mates. They say that there's some sort of trauma. Not really. I mean, there's always the option of the army psychologist or psychiatrist if you so need that. But, I mean, we always knew that we were morally and ethically in the right, you know. There are some guys in my squad who said, you know, it sucks that we have to do this and that it's come to this situation that we have to respond this way. But it is what it is, and really it's the only option that we have, you know. What's the alternative? To let them break through, you know? They've gotten used to the gas. You know, you shoot tear gas at them and they don't even respond to it anymore. They've literally just gotten used to it. So, you know, there are some guys that they admitted, maybe it's a bit uncomfortable, but they knew that ethically and morally they weren't doing anything wrong. And, you know, that's what they had to do and they knew it's their job. And the rest, you know, myself, never really bothered me too much. Again, it's a job, and I knew I was in the right, so... You know, these are people that have tried to kill us.
What about, for example, in situations... And I'm only speaking from what I saw in the news and spoke with my friends who served there, but that there are instances of, let's say, innocent people being harmed, sometimes even killed, and sometimes it's not even your... Okay, you know what? Let's ask this: How come that there are innocent people who are also being harmed when they're there? Because you know who you're shooting at.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. Now, when you say an innocent person, do you mean someone who's getting shot that wasn't the intended target, or?
Yeah, let's say if he wasn't the intended target. Let's say, I mean, I remember a case. There was a Palestinian nurse, I think.
Right,
and she
right.
Came
that's the
and,
very
and
famous.
She died, and
right,
it
that's
made
the famous
a lot of
case.
Headlines around the world.
Yep. Yeah. That wasn't in my squad. That was in the squad beforehand. So I don't know exactly the details.
Okay, but let's say and
from your experience.
Yeah,
right. From
your
my experience. Okay. That. Shooting someone accidentally. You know, let's talk about two things. First of all, at the end of the day, these snipers, I'm a bit older because, you know, I made Aliyah and stuff, but at the end of the day, they're still, you know, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, and we're all human in the end of the day. I can also make this mistake regardless of my age. And there are a lot of people sometimes. When these riots, and they really do turn into riots, I'm talking multiple thousands of people crowded around. It's very hard. And I think a lot of times the media and that doesn't even respect how difficult some of these shots are. And yeah, you shoot. Okay, my squad as a total over 4 months shoots 100 bullets, 200 bullets. You know, you've got to set a percentage aside that maybe a very tiny percentage of those might, there might be a mistake there because we're all humans.
But a mistake, you mean like not he accidentally fired, but he meant to
hit someone else.
Yeah.
And
you
someone
know, walked in the way, kind of.
Yeah, you know, it's a freak accident. You have a clear shot, and the second you pull the trigger, someone walks in front. You can't control that.
Yeah.
And I've had that almost happen to me maybe 4 or 5 times, and it's nerve-wracking, and it's very scary. And the second thing I want to touch on is... again, these people are very smart. They learn very quickly. And a lot of the times, because also another thing to make note of, we're not allowed to shoot women ever. And we're not allowed to shoot kids. So you actually have to identify the age of these guys.
But what do you mean you're not allowed to shoot women?
We never have. We almost never have permission to shoot at a woman. Almost, really in the most extreme situations, you'll have that permission. If you see that she's got some sort of thing that she can cause harm, or if she's on the border itself, on the fence, trying to or climb it or break it down, only then you'll ever have permission.
I didn't know that.
No, we never had permission, ever.
So we were talking about taking a shot and accidentally maybe hitting someone you didn't intend to. But so those mistakes, you say, exist in a very tiny, tiny like case.
For sure.
Like a very tiny amount of cases.
For sure.
And what about mistakes in judgment? Does that happen as well, where you take a shot at someone and it hits the intended target, but the intended target wasn't, it wasn't like justified, you could say, the shot?
Okay, well, yeah, what's not justified? At the end of the day, we have our orders, you know. Anyone beyond this this specific distance, and you see that he's causing issues, and there's a wide range of issues he can create, or he's getting the people more angry, or he's directing the people, you know. 101 things. It doesn't necessarily have to be someone throwing grenades and stuff. It can also be someone who's turning this protest into a riot.
So I think also it can be really hard sometimes to say if you're, you know, 300, 400 meters away.
Oh, 100%. I'm asking the question.
Is it a grenade or is it...
Well, you
know, we have tools to see, you know, pretty decently.
Okay.
And a grenade, you know, if you see something, an object in someone's hand, and, you know, you see how he's walking, he's a bit nervous. And they're always signs.
Okay, all right.
I'm not asking it in a kind of judgmental way.
No, of course.
I'm 100% clear that, like you said, those are kids, and the job is extremely difficult. Maybe the most difficult job.
Of course.
It's insane how difficult it is. But what I'm thinking is, if those kids can perform that their jobs with even, I don't know, 1% of mistakes in judgment, that's a miracle to me. Like, I would think that those things would happen a lot because how hard it is to perform that job. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it doesn't.
Oh, it's technically incredibly difficult. And as a sniper in Gaza, you really don't sleep much. I mean, we do rotations. There are 16 days on the border and then 5 days at home. And it's really 16 days that you will sleep an average of 3 hours maybe every night. So, you know, technically speaking, incredibly hard. I mean, to shoot someone's knee at that kind of distance, if he's a target standing still, it's difficult. To do it when he's moving and then you've got tear gas in your eyes, it's you know, sometimes I think about it and really I don't understand how we managed. But
yeah.
But would you say that those decisions in judgment were those decisions like the judgment was made by higher ups, so you wouldn't usually decide on yourself whether to shoot or not? They would tell you shoot.
And, you know, there was never a shot that we took that, like, we just decided, hey, I'm going to shoot this person, and then you take the shot, and that's it. There was, you know, like I said, you've got the extreme cases where you shoot and then radio it, but those were really the extreme cases in the minority. Normally, you know, you always had some sort of officer or commander with a radio. He would talk to the commander of the platoon. The platoon commander would talk to the battalion commander, and it's really a chain of that.
Have you ever had cases that happened that either you had to take a shot or a friend had to take a shot or something that you just saw in your scope but that really shocked you? That was, you were like, whoa, I can't believe that they would do this, for example.
Yeah, sure. You know, you see a lot of messed up things there.
But like what, for example?
Okay, like I said before, we're not allowed to shoot women and children. Mm-hmm. So... like I mentioned before, you've got some guys that return to these protests every week and they're clearly more adult, and you can see the people are respecting what he's saying and he's really directing the people. So, or he has some connection to Hamas, or you know, he's someone critical to these riots. And you see suddenly that he's walking, he's crossing the green line, let's say, where, you know, you're allowed to shoot, and he's walking and he's got a circle of kids around him.
Really?
Yeah, and they're smart, you know. He'll walk in a way that these kids are always in front of his legs because he knows there's no way we'll be able to shoot now. And, you know, what are you meant to do in this kind of situation? And he's getting closer to the fence. What can you do in this kind of situation?
Man, that is...
And he does that in order to create some sort of...
it's an obstruction. He knows we can't do anything about it.
He knows you're not going to shoot a kid.
Trying to create some sort of provocation. Maybe you would shoot a kid by accident.
Well, it's a win-win for him. Or we don't shoot and he gets to do whatever he wants unimpeded. Or we shoot and take that very high risk that we shoot a child. And then, well, you know, there's also about 1,000 cameras on their side. And now... we've got a great propaganda piece now, how Israel shoots children.
That is insane, man. That is insane. I mean, I know, but it just shocks me every time.
Yeah, yeah.
The difference in the mentality is just, it shocks me every time.
Oh, yeah. And also during that period, like I said, when Hamas stopped supporting these protests,
yeah,
they would actually put people affiliated with Hamas. This happened really a small number of times, but I saw it with my own eyes, where they would actually just make a chain of people on this trail that I talked about that serves as like the line that they're not meant to pass. And when one of the protesters would try to break through, they would actually just start beating him up, like 50 guys on one guy. And just
wait, what do you mean? What do you mean?
So, you know, when Hamas stopped supporting it.
Yeah.
I think it was in the middle of some peace negotiation between Israel. It might have been after that incursion from the Israeli side where they caught them. And then there was a big mess of that. And then there was some peace negotiations.
Okay.
So it was a very sensitive time for Hamas, or something to do with the money. I don't remember. But it was very important to Hamas to keep the peace on the border for that specific time. Yeah. And... so what happened to maintain order, and this is again why I say that you can tell that the civilians are kind of to blame here, they would have to put, you know, Hamas henchmen, I guess, to actually physically stand on that trail and to physically stop anyone from crossing it.
Wow.
And, you know, they would automatically respond with violence. And this could be against...
if someone tried to cross.
Yeah, yeah. And this could be a child, this could be a teenager. They really didn't care. And, yeah, you routinely saw, you know, them beating up children, stuff like that. You know, they really did not care as long as no one crossed.
Wow.
What? What do you? So, I'm thinking about, like, is there like a moment before you have to take a shot? Is there like a moment where, I mean, what's crossing your mind? Is it purely like concentrating on thinking about all the aspects of hitting the shot, or or do you sometimes like think about other stuff, or what happened like in the second before?
Okay,
because I think as a sniper that's like the moment, right? You've been training, and there's you're not fighting, like when you're fighting as a soldier, you're just like fighting. As a sniper, there's this like a single second where everything counts, right? So what's going through your mind in that second?
Yeah, let me think about that, because I've never really thought about that, to be honest.
That's a good question.
Yeah, that is a good question. I don't know what do you guys think how it is, if you think that we see a target and we're like automatically on him and take the shot. It's really not like that. It's a succession of things. You see a guy who you've decided, okay, this is going to be the target for so-and-so reasons. You've already reported it. You get the permission. Yep, this guy deserves this bullet. You know, I guess that's one way you could put it. And, okay, you set up for distance, you set up for wind, you start measuring wind, distance, all that. And then you wait, because you'll never shoot a guy who's running. Because that's another thing that's very important to the IDF. They don't want you to miss, because they know a bullet that can miss, it can ricochet off the ground, it can hit someone accidentally. So that's another general rule for snipers on the border.
So you would wait for the opportunity.
Right. And this opportunity can be for a split second only, but you have to take that shot. But what I meant to say is there's a lot of preparation that goes in before that second that you talked about.
Mm.
Now, that actual second that you pull the trigger, you know, it's a three-step process that you just, you know, we practice this millions of times. So the second before you pull the trigger, it's you take out all the air out of your lungs. You make sure your body is as stable as possible on the ground and isn't moving. And then when you pull the trigger, it's a slow pull. I guess the movies kind of put that wrongly, but it's a very slow pull.
Mm.
And you just make sure you've got no air in your lungs, and you know, in that second you
slow pull. What do you mean, like the trigger moves slowly?
On the trigger, yeah. You have to move it because if you do it fast, you can jerk the gun, and that can affect it.
I want to ask. It's slightly, let's say, off topic, but I kind of want to get to know the real Isaac behind everything we just spoke about.
Yeah, we're talking about it for 50 minutes, and it's only because it's so interesting.
It's so interesting because it's a first person account.
But it's important to.
So what? Like, what made you decide? Okay, I'm gonna move to Israel. I'm leaving London. I'm coming to Israel.
Well, it was partly spur of the moment, and partly a lot of thought went into it. Because beforehand, I'll be honest, I was never in like a Jewish community. I didn't go to Jewish schools. For a lot of my life, I was, or we were the only Jewish family in the neighborhood, or I was like the only Jew in my circle of friends. So I never really took that much interest into Israel, to be honest.
So what happened?
So I read a lot, like a lot. And one day I just picked up, you know, spur of the moment, picked up a book about modern Israel that really talked about its history, its economic situation, geographic situation. It was really a general book.
Do you remember the name of the book?
Yeah, of course. I even have it here with me. I brought it from abroad. You know, it's such an important book to me. It's called Israel's Place in the World. And it's written by someone you may have heard of, Bibi Netanyahu.
I wasn't expecting that.
Rings a bell. The name rings a bell.
But he wrote it in the 1990s when he was in the UN. It was really just a general, but he wrote it because he felt that in the UN no one really knew Israel enough, so he wrote this book to just give a lot of general information. Mm-hmm. And after that, I was really hooked. I don't know why, but I was hooked on this information. I immediately bought like 5 or 10 more books about Israel, read them all. And after that, I just said, well, I guess I'm going to make Aliyah now.
Wow. Nice. So it's like, it's a bit like, it's funny, but it's, I don't know why, and just the way you said it right now, I saw a little bit of similarities before, like with your sniper story, that you are like, there's a lot of preparation that comes before, but at some point you just take the shot, you know?
Yeah, I can say there was, you know, spontaneous in that, but when I really think about it, yeah, there was some building to it before, you know?
Yeah.
I'd never felt connected to... I thought about it, you know, I've never been connected to Jews, really, you know?
What do you feel is the... Do you feel that there's like a big change that happened in you since you moved to Israel? Do you feel like you think differently about stuff now? You see things differently?
Well, in general, I think, you know, the older you get, you're always going to see things slightly differently.
Yeah, that's
and change.
True. Yeah.
If you see the world the same at 50 as at 20, then I guess you haven't lived.
That's smart, man.
Yeah,
he's, deep. Smart guy. He's a smart guy.
It's a smart thing to say.
Okay, yeah. Very deep.
Deep thinker.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, the Gaza conflict, I had no idea, but I didn't even know who Bibi Netanyahu was, you know.
No, but the way you look at life, let's say, not necessarily politically, just how you experience your life.
Yeah, of course, definitely. And also my time in the army, you know, 2 years, it changes a person, right? And, yeah, I've got my grandparents here, and I help them out a lot at home with cleaning, cooking, you know, laundry and stuff. So, you know, it makes me appreciate stuff like that before that maybe I didn't appreciate beforehand. Yeah, what can I tell you? Yeah, we're always constantly changing and evolving, I guess, and I'm no different.
Nice.
We talked about the army and sniping and moving here to Israel, but I think that you're a person, right? You're
last,
a human.
Last I checked,
you're a human being, and yeah, you were a sniper and this and that. But what do you like? How's your life looking like after? So you left the army now, and what interests you? What do you want to do? How do you see your life? Like, what's your hobbies? Because I think there's it's important to remember there's a person behind.
Right.
The,
yeah.
The
I
stories.
Feel like I've really stereotyped myself as a sniper. You know,
yes,
I was
it's
born
so funny
to
because
kill.
This is a question that needs to be asked at the beginning, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Usually you ask at the beginning, but I feel that now, like, maybe tell about yourself
yeah,
a little bit
course.
Because
so yeah, there are parts of me not related to being a sniper. I am a human being, as you said. Hobbies, you know, like I mentioned, I love reading. I read all sorts of stuff, the classics and a lot of nonfiction. What else? Chess. I love playing chess. I used to be I boxed in the amateur ranks for 6 or 7 years.
Wow, nice. We should spar.
It might happen, you know, the day will come.
Slight height
difference.
Yeah, yeah.
Much larger than you.
Yeah, yeah. Sure, for those who don't know, the height difference here is, well, you know, David and Goliath happen, so.
Yeah, to be honest, he's much larger than basically anyone on
yeah,
the planet.
Yeah, yeah. Every time I see him, I tell him, or I've gotten shorter, or you've gotten bigger, you know.
just Tom is 2 meters, 4 centimeters high. That's
three. Let's not
two
exaggerate.
Meters.
No, God forbid.
So but if you love chess, you would love Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Yeah, well, you know, there's also elements of that in boxing. You know, yeah. Also in everyone
strategic.
Tells me that about
very strategic. But
so you've got to think ahead and that. Yeah.
I was gonna ask them, now that you're out of the army, what do you plan on doing? What's interesting, like in terms of job, study, or what?
So you know, I want to study here in Israel. You know, for the foreseeable future, I'm staying here. Economics. I worked. In finance before, so I have some sort of background there, so I figured, okay, I might as well get a degree in this. And yeah, I'd love to go back to work into finance.
Finance.
Nice, cool, man.
Yeah. A bit anticlimactic from the sniper
yeah,
stories.
Yeah,
but that's the thing, right? That's like some, because it's all names in the, like in the news or whatever, or it's all mm-hmm. like, places you hear about on TV, or but behind all those stories, behind the shots, behind the tear
yeah,
gas,
people.
Behind
yeah.
behind the people trying to break the fence, there's always people on both sides.
Yeah,
and
I think also people can sometimes forget that it's like the thing. In every army, of course, it's always people. But let's say if you take the Israeli army for example. These are genuinely people that are being pulled out of the civilian population, getting drafted,
mm-hmm.
going to the army for 3 years,
mm-hmm.
and then moving out. Like, you know, I'm a dentist. I will be a dentist soon, hopefully, if I pass all
hopefully,
my exams.
Hopefully.
Yeah, but,
probably
you know,
not.
But thank you. But I was a medic. You were studying design and you were in intelligence, you know, but these are really ordinary people from everyday life.
And, media and politics and those kind of things often demonize, right? Because people in Gaza, they're so us as Israelis are always demonized in Gaza and other way around, and
mm-hmm.
they always see that the army are monsters, and we hear that Hamas are monsters, and everyone are monsters, and no one but everyone are people eventually. And yeah, some of them have harmful intents.
Yeah,
but behind the organization with the political and harmful intents and political goals and stuff like that, there are normal people here and there.
Yeah.
And when you think about how everyone are just normal people, then it kind of makes you think about the whole situation behind.
Yeah, but also it's because when you look at the media, you have to remember the media wants to sell you something, and it's either advertisements that they're selling to you, or it's an agenda or a story or something like that that they bring to you, and they want you to leave the story with a certain perception. And let's say, okay, the Israeli basketball team under 20 won the European Championship for the second time now
mm-hmm.
in a row.
Yeah.
But it will never sell as a dead nurse in Gaza or a child being shot by accident or whatever.
Yeah. I mean,
unfortunately.
There's proof of that on the answer I gave on Quora. You know, it's such a hotly debated topic, you know. I'm sure if I wrote about finance, it would not have gone.
Probably
50,000.
Not. No, we should put up the link to his Quora question in the. It's really good, really good answer.
What I want to say just to finish is to answer you, because I think that because like you said, the media is trying to sell us stories, then maybe it's our responsibility as people to remind ourselves that there's also people on the other side.
Right.
Yeah.
And not that we can. There's a lot we can do about it, but. just so we would always remember that. And
yeah. There's always something
we can
do.
Try. Yeah, like, you know, we can try.
Yeah,
Isaac.
Man, God bless you, my friend. You here. Oh,
thank you. It was good to be here.
Great
thank
having
you for coming.
You.
Yeah, it was very, very interesting. And thank you for coming and telling your stories and everything. And we'll put up the link for the Quora question.
Thank you. Thank you.
And yeah.
Awesome, man. Awesome. All right, guys. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you very much
for being with us.
Thank you, Isaac.
Thank you. See you next time. Yalla, bye.
Bye bye.